You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Stephen L. Carter, who is the William Nelson Cromwell Professor of Law at Yale University, has written 7 critically acclaimed works of nonfiction and received praise from a diverse group that includes William F. Buckley and Bill Clinton. His first try at the novel form, The Emperor of Ocean Park, became a runaway bestseller, and now he's followed that with New England White. It's just been published by Knopf, and I'm pleased that it has brought Stephen Carter back to my show. And it's already predicted. I don't know what the sales are, but one review said Carter rivals Scott Turow. Expect another bestseller. Well, is that what you have in mind here? Are you trying to reach the widest possible audience in a way that you couldn't with your nonfiction books?
Every writer wants to reach the widest possible audience. And as a novelist, I write first and foremost to entertain. I think one reason I write in the form of thrillers is I just want people to have fun reading them. It's not mainly a vehicle for arguing about other things, although if I manage to tweak people's views on issues a little bit, so much the better. But if the social comment passes by them and they simply read it for the fun of the story, as a writer, that still for me is entirely satisfying.
In this case, you have gone back to 2 minor characters from The Emperor of Ocean Park, Le Master and Julia Carlyle. Had they been sitting there at the back of your head after you finished the first book?
They were. In the first novel, Misha Garland, the somewhat envying narrator of The Emperor of Ocean Park, refers to the Carlyles, have a very minor role there, as perfect. The marriage is perfect, they're perfect, their children are perfect, and so on. And I think as I tried to think of, as I kicked around ideas about which characters in the first novel to explore further, I was intrigued by the idea of taking a seemingly perfect family and putting them in the midst of a mystery that would tug them along against their will and expose certain strains and so on to our view.
And we'd, of course, and also expose certain things about their past that can make their marriage look a lot less than perfect.
Well, that's right. And I think in that sense, a lot of us are in one way or the other haunted by our past. We all have things we'd rather not dwell on and certainly rather not have other people think about or dwell on. So what do you do when suddenly you come face to face with those things that you'd rather not think about and those things enmesh you in a murder mystery? What does that do to a family like the Carlyles that one thinks is perfect? And that was what I was trying to get at.
And also, what happens when a perfect university turns out to have a troubled past? And I'm sure that that was part of your thinking, to parallel a personal story with an institutional story.
I have a view about college campuses that they are inherently scary places. No, people don't usually get that at first.
You've lived most of your life on them.
Well, I know, but you think about a college campus, all these towers, often very gothic towers, and you know what? At night, they're empty. There's a light on here or there, but these big, empty buildings with students hurrying past, bundled against the weather. I just think that invites us to ask what lies beneath, what's hidden beneath the placid surface of the college and its traditions and its history. I'm fascinated by the idea of setting a mystery on a college campus because they seem to be such scary places.
But you do say at one point at the end of the novel in an author's note, you have several paragraphs about how your book should not be perceived as accurate portrayals of New Haven or Yale, because people were going to assume that it is. After all, the character, the master, Carlyle, kind of looks like you.
Well, except he's very short, I hope, and I'm kind of tall. But
well, it is a work of fiction.
It's natural, I think. I teach at Yale. I've been teaching there for 25 years. It's natural for people to think I'm writing about Yale. And certainly Yale's the campus I know best. New Haven is the town I know best. But the campus and the town are inventions. I'm not trying to play on any place or any character. I just am trying to invent a fictional world where I can make things happen the way that seemed to me to be most interesting and exciting.
And in this case, you haven't made Le Master your protagonist. You've made his wife, Julia. You've also written this book in third person, whereas The Emperor of Ocean Park was in first person. Just because you're trying out your writing chops, or because you are writing pretty much about a woman, and you didn't want to say I.
When I wrote my first novel, The Amber of Ocean Park, which was written in the first person, I found that very difficult because the character I invented, Misha Garland, was so unlike myself. Sustaining that voice was hard work. Doing a book mainly from the point of view of Julia, a woman, when I'm a man, was, of course, very hard work as well. But if you think about it, I think that serious fiction is always hard work. It should never be easy to find the narrator's voice. There should always be an invention, and that act of invention is part of the fun. So, yes, it was very hard creating a story in which the major character is a woman, but it was also a great challenge and a lot of fun doing it.
We mentioned that this is this occurs in academia, but it's happening to a prominent African-American couple in, as the master describes it, the heart of whiteness. So did you think of this as a murder mystery first, or did you think of this as a story about race and politics?
I thought of it first as a story about these characters. I was interested in an African-American family holding powerful positions, living in an all-white town. I was interested in a family that had connections. You remember LeMaster's college roommate is the president of the United States. His other roommate.
You start off telling us right in the very first paragraph.
Yeah, but I think that for me, I always start with the characters, and then I create a story to fit them, to raise the tension in their lives. In this case, a story is about murder and about politics, electoral, national, presidential politics, but also a story about history. Because remember, there are two murders in the book. There's a murder that happens when the book begins, and there's another murder that happened 30 years ago, a teenage girl who was killed in the same town. And it's the possibility of a link between these that lends the book some of its historical thread and some of the tension regarding the presidential campaign as well.
And Julia is also, is it the assistant dean of a divinity school?
She's within the dean of students. Yeah.
Within the university that her husband is the president of. So is this also about religion on some level?
On some level, at least the characters have religious lives. One thing that's really striking about modern fiction, we live in a country where, for better or worse, 90% of the people say they believe in God, and around half of the people, a little less than half, say they regularly attend religious services. But in modern fiction, it's very rare for people to have religious lives unless the religion is somehow central to the plot. For me, giving characters religious lives is part of creating a well-rounded character. Although I was interested in using a divinity school in part as it's a device about contrast. The murdered man was an economist, and he saw the world in hard materialistic terms. Things are valued according to the market. And Julia is at the divinity school, where they see the notion of what things are worth a little bit differently. And that contrast in styles, beliefs, visions of the world was also one I wanted to explore a little bit in the fiction.
My guest is Stephen L. Carter. His latest book is his second novel, this one called New England White, published by Knopp. The victim, the economics professor, Kellen Zant, has also made a career out of race.
It's funny. He's described as one of the most prominent economists in the country, but he's also he's black, and he's an economist who often, we're told, gets consulting jobs by calling up corporations and saying, how come you don't have any black consultants? The more interesting role he plays in the novel, of course, is he's murdered in the first chapter. In the second chapter, we discover that he was Julia's ex-lover, that before she married LeMaster, the husband who protects her and is faithful to her, she had this very destructive relationship with the murdered man, with Kellen Zant. And it's through the exploration of that past that we begin to look into these questions of national politics as well.
Throughout the book, we get many clues related to economics and the idea of a surplus.
You know, I had a lot of fun with that. And people have told me they found it a little odd, but I had fun with the notion that an economist, knowing his life was in danger, on the track of an important mystery, might leave some clues behind where he used the language most familiar to him. And, of course, one of Julia's problems as she struggles to follow these clues is she maybe doesn't know that much economics, but she learns what she needs to know, I guess, along the way, because that's the form in which he left the clues, his little economic puzzles.
The older murder, the 30-year-old murder, is also involves race. And I wonder how much of your thinking was inspired by what's been happening. Is it at Brown, where Brown has been looking into its institutional past and its connection to slavery? And then I assume that while you were writing this book, the Duke University lacrosse players' case suddenly burst into the the public consciousness and all of the tensions that that has stirred up.
Well, the Duke case, I had largely finished the book by then, but certainly not only Brown, but other universities that have tried to lay bare their souls, as it were, with regard to their own past and so on, I think has been one influence. There's another one also, that we live in an era when in America itself there is a declining attention to issues of poverty and race as other issues take center stage. And one of the things that interested me writing the book is how African Americans maybe might respond, the kind of sense of panic you almost see from some of the people in the book when they realize that race no longer has center stage in our national politics.
Many people, I'm sure, have asked you, I think I did the last time you were here, about how somebody with a long, respected career as a legal scholar and essayist could wind up writing best-selling novels. And one critic suggested that a theme throughout all of your work is human weakness.
I think that's fair.
The nonfiction, the fiction,
yeah,
no matter what.
No, I think it's fair. I would put it slightly differently. I would say human complexity. That is, I think all of us are creatures of enormous aspiration. We have views. We may differ in our views. We all have views about what we want to be, what we think we ought to be. One of the great battles internally for most of us is the desire, the wanting of one thing, and the feeling we should want or should do another thing. Some of my other work focuses on that, and certainly in the novels, I have no patience with larger-than-life heroes, with people without flaw. I'm interested in people who have flaws, people who have to struggle to overcome them, people who are faced with the same complexity all of us face every day. I know I should do X, but I really want to do Y. I wouldn't necessarily call it weakness. I would just call it our complexity. It's the difference between our desires and our aspirations.
You wrote in the New York Times book review some time back that writing fiction had given you diabetes. Is that possible?
I don't know if I want to put it quite that. I'm sorry if I put it quite that way. It's that I was diagnosed with diabetes about the time I finished my first novel. My wife tells me every time I write a novel, I get sick. That's the way that she puts it. She's trying to protect me and not work so hard.
You're eating candy and stuff?
No, I don't think it's that. My main problem is this. Because I'm a full-time law professor and I don't want to slight my work as a law professor and legal scholar, I have to squeeze my writing into evenings and weekends, which means I don't get as much rest as I probably should or as much recreation as I probably should because I'm always squeezing in time to write. And it may be, my wife is always telling me that the time will come when I have to make a choice between these two careers that I love, writing fiction and being a legal scholar. I don't look forward to the possibility of having to choose between them. I really don't. I hope I could somehow avoid that choice.
Are you going to continue writing murder mysteries? Although the Washington Post review, which is a rave, does say, be honest, no one should read a Carter novel for the mystery.
Well, you know, let me say this about my future plans. I do have a novel coming out next summer. I have which is kind of a mystery. It's a little bit different, a little more ambitious. It covers 20 years of American history. It begins in the 1950s, about the time Browning's Board of Education is decided, and it ends in the 70s, about the time Richard Nixon resigns. And there is a mystery that is central to the story, but there's more to the mystery than solving a murder. And it's one that has national implications. So I do have some other ambitions, but I also want to get back to my nonfiction writing. I have other nonfiction projects I want to pursue as well.
Had you wanted to write fiction all along?
From the time I was a child. I wrote short stories and what I called novels when I was a really little boy growing up in Washington, D.C. I'd write in these little spiral notebooks. I'd write stories, dinosaurs taking over the world, being defeated by a plucky little boy, things like that. I think there was a part
more
of me...
More autobiographical in those things.
Oh, well, exactly. I always knew that I would be somehow be saving the world. No. Well, the thing is, I've always enjoyed writing. Everything I've done, every job I've had when I've been in school, the part I've liked the best is putting words on the page, and that's still what I enjoy the best.
And you are an anomaly, or a relative anomaly, because anyone who's read a legal brief knows that lawyers, legal minds, cannot write decent sentences. You write quite wonderful sentences.
Well, I appreciate that. I've always believed, and I always try to teach my students at the law school, that there's no such thing as legal writing. It's distinct from ordinary writing, that people should just write well. And if a lawyer writes well, that'll be fine legal writing.
Stephen L. Carter's latest novel is New England White, published by Knopf. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.